Hello, this is Rita Schulte, and I will be reading excerpts from the Bloomington Pantograph for Saturday, October 24th, Sunday, October 25th, and Monday, October 26th. We'll begin with the front page of the Saturday, October 24th, 2020 Pantograph. The headline reads, "Love This Place, Mark First to Move, Expand Pediatric Therapy Center." A smiling Alexa Kruger jumped in a foam pit, climbed through a tunnel, slid down a slide, and played on swings. "It's cool. I love this place," the 4-year-old Bloomington girl said. To Alexa, she was just having fun on a Friday afternoon, but to Sarah Burge, Alexa's occupational therapist, the child's individual sensory needs were being met as she was having fun. All of this is being done in a sensory gym that is part of a new, larger location for Mark First Pediatric Therapy. Mark First Pediatric Therapy will relocate in November from 1,100 square feet at its current facility, 1606 Hunt Drive, Normal, to 4,700 square feet in the lower level of Carl Broman Medical Office Building, number 1, 1302 Franklin Avenue in Normal. On Friday afternoon, some children, like Alexa, who are served by the program and community partners who helped to cover the $500,000 to renovate and equip the space, got tours, which were spread out to allow for social distancing during the COVID-19 pandemic. "It's fabulous," said Alexa's mother, Amanda. "There are many more opportunities for her to get the help she needs." The space will be named the Greg Chadwick Mark First Pediatric Therapy Center in memory of Chadwick, the Mark First Chief Operating Officer who died in September. "It's a tremendous honor," said Chadwick's wife, Robin Walter, that is. "As his family, we really appreciate Mark First staff and board recognition of his work. Greg would have found it completely unnecessary. He would have said, Mark First is a good name, but there's no need to add more. But I think he would be touched as well. We're really thrilled for Mark First and what the center can provide for kids in the community and how this opens doors for Mark First's continued growth," Walter said. "The pediatric therapy program provides occupational, physical, speech, feeding, and social, emotional, and applied behavior analysis services for children with autism. For children from birth to age 14, said Christy Kosharik, Mark First Vice President of Pediatric Therapy Services. The center includes the sensory gym with movable swings, zip lines, climbing walls, foam pit, rings, stairs, ramps, slides, monkey bars, and tunnels. Burge said the space is at least twice the size of Mark First's previous gym. This space will make my job easier, she said. In the previous gym, she had to confine the therapy to the space. Now she won't have to do that, and the space is large enough to accommodate more than one child at a time, meaning they can also work on social skills. That means I can meet the child's individual sensory needs more easily because I have the space and equipment to do it," Berg said. For example, Alexa has sensory processing challenges. An occupational therapist has been working with her since June on her insecurities going downstairs, sensory feeding difficulties, and communicating with peers. By running, jumping, climbing, going down the slide, and crashing in the foam pit, she is getting a ton of proprioceptive and vestibular input, which is helping to regulate her sensory system, Burge said. I have noticed so many improvements, Amanda Kruger said of Alexa. She's eating better, she's talking more, she's not as afraid, and is more open to new experiences. In addition to the sensory gym, the new center includes a dedicated serial casting room for children who need soft casts to improve their balance and gait, a gross motor gym, and 4 therapy spaces for individual and group experiences, Kosharik said. The program served more than 700 children last year. Koshirek estimated that the larger center will allow the caseload to be doubled. The program, which has added two therapists and two therapist assistants, recently has about 30 employees, Koshirek said. We're just so blessed the community has embraced this project, said Mark First CEO Brian Wipperman. This space allows us to see multiple children at the same time. The impact on the community will be greater because the children and the families won't have to wait for the services. Other Mark First services and offices remain on Hunt Drive. They include the high school transition support, employment, residential, and day programs, and a behavioral health clinic for adults. Mark First overall serves 1,000 children and adults with behavioral disabilities and delays and has almost 160 full and part-time employees, Wipperman said. Also from page A1, the headline reads, Mail delays persist as voting surges. U.S. Postal Service records show delivery delays have persisted across the country as millions of Americans are voting by mail, raising the possibility of ballots being rejected because they arrived too late. Postal data through October 9th, released through a federal court order, show nearly all of the agency's delivery regions missing its target of having at least 95% of first-class mail arrive within 5 days. Parts of the presidential battleground states of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Ohio fell short of delivery goals by wide margins as the agency struggles to regain its footing after a tumultuous summer. The districts that include the major urban areas and their suburbs in each of those states all perform below the national average for on-time delivery, with the area around Pittsburgh in western Pennsylvania the lone exception. The delays are a worrisome sign for voters who still have not returned their absentee ballots. That especially is true in states such as Michigan, where ballots must be received by Election Day. Other states require a postmark by November 3rd. We do encourage people who are worried about ballots not getting the here on time to get them in as soon as possible, said Perry County Commissioner Brenda Watson in Pennsylvania. She said her office has sent out more than 600,000 absentee ballots, more than double from the primary, and has extended office hours so staff can monitor a drop box. With more than 2.9 million mail-in ballots requested in Pennsylvania, on-time delivery is crucial. But delays are lingering throughout the state, according to the agency's most reliable and available data released as part of the federal court order. In a related story on page A3, Illinois early voting surges. 1.8 million ballots cast so far. COVID upends voting patterns. Amid a new surge in COVID-19 cases, voters in Illinois and across the nation are shattering records for early voting. As of Friday, according to Illinois State Board of Elections, more than 1.8 million voters had already cast their ballots for the November 3rd general election. Nationally, the U.S. Elections Project at the University of Florida estimates that 50 million Americans have already voted. In a normal election year, a large number of early votes would be seen as an indicator of high interest in the races and a predictor of overall high voter turnout. But because of the pandemic, 2020 is turning out to be a year like no other, and one local analyst cautioned observers not to read too much into the numbers, at least not yet. I'm willing to say I don't know what it means yet, and we're going to be looking closely at the final returns, Brian Gaines, a political science professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, said during an interview for Capital News Illinois podcast. If I have to guess right now, I'd say, first of all, it was a success, for there was a deliberate effort to nudge people toward voting by mail, a little bit less to vote early, to reduce lines on Election Day. During the pandemic-shortened legislative session in May, Illinois lawmakers passed a bill requiring local election officials to send out mail ballot request forms to nearly every voter in Illinois. More than 2.3 million voters, Illinois voters, returned those forms, according to state election officials, And as of Friday, with 11 days remaining before the election, slightly more than 1 million, or 45%, had returned those ballots. On page A6, another sort of companion article, headline contested, "What happens if the results are up in the air?" from the Associated Press. Is it possible the election will be up in the air and we won't have a president on Inauguration Day, January 20th, 2021? Even if the election is messy and contested in court, the country will have a president on Inauguration Day. The Constitution and federal law ensure it. Here's what happens after the voters go to the polls on November 3rd. First, states have more than a month to count ballots, including the expected surge of mail-in ballots and to conduct counts if necessary. Recounts, that is. But states' electoral votes must be cast on December 14th. Courts will be mindful of that in refereeing any disputes. During the 2000 election, the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately ended Florida's vote recount, saying time had run out before the electors were set to meet. When the electors meet, the candidate who gets at least 270 of the 538 electoral votes wins. But what happens if election issues still prevent a winner from being named? Well, the Constitution has an answer. The 12th Amendment says in that case, the House of Representatives elects the president, and the Senate elects the vice president. The new Congress that enters in January is the one tasked with carrying out the so-called contingent election. The president has only been selected this way once, in 1825. The winner was John Quincy Adams. In a contingent election, House members have to choose among the three people with the most electoral votes. Each state delegation gets one vote, and 26 votes are required to win. In the Senate, the choice is between the top two electoral vote getters, and each senator gets a vote, with 51 votes required to win. What if that fails and the House hasn't elected a president by Inauguration Day? Then the 20th Amendment takes over. It says the vice president-elect acts as president until a president is picked. And if there is no vice president-elect by Inauguration Day, well then, the Presidential Succession Act applies. It says that the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Senate President, or a cabinet officer in that order, would act as president until there is a president or vice president. And basically an outline of the dates, settling an unsettled election. If the presidential election is not decided when the state-chosen electors meet December 14th to cast their electoral votes, the Constitution and federal law outline a procedure to ensure president and vice president take over. And here's the timeline. Americans vote November 3rd and their votes are tallied. Electors meet December 14th to vote. If there's a candidate with 270 or more votes, the election is settled. That candidate is elected and sworn in on Inauguration Day, January 20th, 2021. If a candidate does not have 270 or more votes, the House of Representatives votes, one per state, 26 needed to elect. The Vice President, Senate votes, one vote per senator, 51 needed to elect. If presidential candidate receives at least 26 House votes by Inauguration Day, he's elected, or she. If a presidential candidate does not receive at least 26 House votes, a VP candidate has been chosen. VP acts as president until the president is elected. If a VP elect has not been chosen, Speaker of the House, President pro tem of the Senate, or cabinet officer acts as president until a president is elected. If vice presidential candidate receives at least 51 Senate votes by Inauguration Day, candidate is elected. If vice presidential candidate does not, The Senate continues until a vice president is elected. And a couple of other facts about our election. While on December 14th, state electors cast their ballots to find out if what candidate has 270 or more votes, on January 6th, a joint session of Congress convenes with Vice President Mike Pence presiding to certify the results. On January 20th, the President and Vice President are sworn in. And deadlines to return ballots by mail do vary. The earliest is Louisiana, November 2nd, and the latest is Washington State on November 23rd. And from local and state news, headline reads, "More retiring as fire chief." The fire chief of Bloomington, Illinois, Brian Moore, will retire next month after nearly 30 years with the Bloomington Fire Department, officials announced on Friday. "I'm truly honored to have been given the opportunity to serve in many different capacities with the Bloomington Fire Department and will cherish the memories and friendships made throughout my career," Moore said in this statement. Moore began his career with the fire department in 1991. He was promoted in 2011 to shift commander, assistant chief, and assistant chief. In 2013, he became training officer and was promoted to fire chief in 2015. "Chief Moore has done an outstanding job leading this department and protecting our community," said Mayor Terry Renner. "We owe the chief a debt of gratitude. He will surely be missed." An interim fire chief will be named in the near future. "I appreciate Chief Moore's nearly 30 years of service to the city and wish him the very best in his retirement," said City Manager Tim Gleason. "He's been an excellent example of dedication, professionalism, and upstanding character. This is a tremendous loss to the city and to the Bloomington Fire Department. Brian is a man of the utmost integrity and character and has earned the respect of staff and the community." Also from page A3, the headline reads, "Judge weighs splitting murder trials. McNabb, Hebert charged in 2019 Orchard Road shooting." A McLean County judge will decide in November whether to separate two murder defendants accused in a 2019 shooting in Bloomington when they go to trial. Judge Casey Costigan heard arguments Friday afternoon from defense attorneys and prosecutors on a defense motion to sever the cases of defendants Amari McNabb, 21, and Exodus Hebert, 20. McNabb and Hebert are both charged with murder and mob action in the deaths of Juan Nash, 25, who was shot April 2, 2019, in the 1200 block of Orchard Road at an outdoor party. McNabb is also charged with aggravated discharge of a firearm. Their co-defendant in this case, Scotty Allen, was tried separately in June after he asserted his right to a speedy trial. He was found guilty of first-degree murder, aggravated discharge of a firearm, and mob action. Allen was sentenced in August to 50 years in prison. McNabb's attorney, Edward Johnson, filed the motion to separate the defendants. He said he believes conflicting defenses will be presented at trial, which would be a problem, especially if one testifies and the other does not. Hebert's attorney, Mark Messman, agreed with Johnson's motion and said the defenses were subtly antagonistic towards each other. Referencing evidence presented during Allen's trial, Messman said the defenses could point blame based on where each defendant was located when the shooting took place. Assistant State's Attorney Aaron Frederick argued against the motion, saying the motion must include the specific antagonistic defense between the defendants, and the defense motion does not do that. Frederick said the state did not know of any statements made by either defendant in their police interviews that suggested they were blaming each other. Nowhere in those transcripts, nowhere in those interviews does Mr. Hebert say to Mr. McNabb, "He did it, I'm innocent." Nowhere in those transcripts, nowhere in his interviews, does Mr. McNabb say, "Mr. Hebert did it, I'm innocent," Frederick said. There is no antagonistic defense that they can identify because there isn't one. Costigan said he will rule on the motion at the next hearing, November 12th, and will allow for Johnson and Messman to supplement the motion with more specifics. The judge will also hear any pending motions in this case at the November hearing. The case is scheduled to go to trial December 7th, but Johnson said he is likely to file a motion to postpone the proceedings. In Friday's hearing, Costigan granted the state's motion to allow for the lead investigator, Sergeant Jared Bierbaum, to sit at the counsel table during trial over objections from both defense attorneys. A motion to sever the mob action charge from McNabb's other charges was denied Friday as well. On page A5, headline reads, Beer Nuts Store Shut Through Holidays. The Beer Nuts Company store at 103 North Robinson Street in Bloomington will remain closed through the holiday season because of the coronavirus pandemic, officials announced on Friday. It's disappointing because we're doing our best to recreate an online experience, but it isn't the same as coming in and seeing a decorated store, said Beer Nuts marketing manager Jonathan Strupek. People come in with address books full of people they want to send gifts to, and that's a special experience for a lot of people that we are sad we can't have. But we are doing our best to recreate as much as possible that experience online. Strupek said the decision to close the store was done in May due to safety reasons related to the coronavirus pandemic. For the safety of our customers and our team members, the company store will remain closed to the public this holiday season to enable the continued safe manufacturing of products for local and national distribution, he said. Strupek said it's difficult to speculate on when the store might reopen, but the company will continue to fulfill orders on the beernuts.com website, which includes free one-day local delivery on all orders over $40. Beer Nuts is actively working on contacting those who visited the store and providing a phone number or email during the 2019 season to ensure notification of this year's changes, officials said. Although the store is often busy throughout the year, its closure hasn't affected sales, Strupek said. We're doing fine, he said. We're very fortunate that we can still get product out across the nation and locally in stores such as Walmart, Menards, Target, Dollar Tree, Hy-Vee, Schnucks, Jewel, and Home Goods. Customer support is always available Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. by a phone at 1-800-BEER-NUTS or email at support@beernuts.com. Longer holiday hours will take effect in mid-November. In this article from Sunday's paper on the local economy, Central Illinois harvest steady. Dry weather speeds work, but yield varies. Because of a dry summer that stretched into fall, most Central Illinois farmers are ahead of schedule for the harvest season, but the lack of rain has cut into expected yields. We had this dry stretch where we were able to knock off a lot of it in a hurry and it got us ahead of average as far as getting the crop out, said Aaron Rader, who farms west of Normal near Hudson. But we could have used a little more rain over the summer. As of October 18th, Illinois farmers had harvested 66% of the corn crop, 1% above the five-year average, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. 81% of the soybeans had been harvested, 15% higher than the average of the previous 5 years. I'm getting close to being done, said McLean County farmer Toby Freight, a corn and soybean farmer near Bloomington, and I have been fairly happy with the results I've been getting. Rader said his yields are about average. We have had some really good corn and then some average corn, and with the beans, those are pretty much all about average. Nothing spectacular for us, he added. It's going to end up being about an average crop compared to the last several years. The agriculture sector across the country also has been dealing with various issues of COVID-related, from softening demand because of closed restaurants to increased infection rates in some rural areas to various trade issues. A powerful windstorm in August also caused damage across the Midwest, with Iowa losing about 850,000 crop-producing acres. The USDA last month released an additional $14 billion in COVID relief funding for farmers. The Illinois Farm Bureau also created a multi-part COVID action plan about adapting into the future. Today, beans around central Illinois have been reported to range anywhere from 65 to 85 bushels per acre, and some of the corn has approached 250 bushels per acre, but most have averaged closer to 200 bushels per acre. The USDA estimated average soybean yields at 60 bushels per acre in Illinois, down 4 bushels from the August estimate. The average corn yields were estimated at 203 bushels per acre. By and large, I would say the yields have been a little bit better than we expected, said Thomas Wargel, a farm manager and owner of Black Prairie Ag Services in Clinton. There's a lot of variability. There's a variability every year, but this year there's more variability this year. Some farmers planted early and prior to cold and wet conditions that did not help the corn germinate quickly and evenly, Wargel said. Actually, the yields turned out better than expected considering the dry August. You can tell who got rain in August because if they got any rain that month, their yields are a little bit better. You can tell the rain played a major part, Rader said. Some are dramatically different. We farm some fields with slight hills on them. The sides of the hills where we didn't get any rain there for a while took the August heat pretty hard. You could tell a big difference between what got rain and what didn't. Mike Stacy, president of Macon County Farm Bureau, who farms near Niantic, said his yields largely depended upon when the crop was planted. It's been a good harvest, he said. We have some ground that had some water damage early, and the yields are down, but for the most part, we are pretty pleased with the yields we have been getting. Most of the other farmers are saying the same thing. Soybean yields are a little better than expected, but the planting date seems to have a lot to do with the outcome of the yields. In Coles County, the first reviews of the harvest have been positive, said Coles County Farm Bureau Manager Tanya Ike. I think yields are going well and the harvest is going well for the majority. We have some issues with combine fires, but with the quick response of all of our fire departments and volunteers, everything has turned out okay. According to the USDA Crop Productions Report, Illinois farmers are expected to harvest 615 million bushels of corn this year, up 16% from last year. All agree that the harvest weather has been close to perfect. They've been going pretty much nonstop since Labor Day, Wargel said. Freight said last week's rains came at a good time. Whether the weather is suitable for field work, you have a mindset not to stop until it rains, he said. Some rain now and then doesn't hurt anything at this point. While keeping one eye on the fields, Central Illinois farmers are also keeping a close eye on the price of soybeans and corn. During the latter stages of summer, the price of beans climbed to about $2 a bushel, up to almost $10 a bushel. Corn has increased about 80 cents per bushel, close to almost $3 a bushel. There's been a pretty good rally on both crops from the time we planted until now, and so we made good strides in that regard, Rader said. That's kind of helped the mood out. There have been several disaster events in Iowa, and things that have caused those prices are always sad to see. But it helps when you are gaining money toward the harvest. That usually doesn't happen like that. This has been Rita Schulte reading excerpts from the Bloomington Pantograph from Saturday, October 24th, Sunday, October 25th, and Monday, October 26th. I will return in just a few moments with the second half, so please stay tuned.